right, welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Preston Connor, and I'll be your host for today's forum. The Hinckley Institute of Politics was established in 1965 through the generous bequest of the Noble Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships to students of all majors here locally in Washington, D.C., and in 55 countries around the globe. The Hinckley Institute also offers classes, the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences to Washington, D.C., and over $70,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door or to our website, www.hinckley.utah.edu, for more information. The Hinckley Institute of Politics proudly presents the 17th annual Rocco C. and Marion S. Siciliano Forum. This year's theme is the future of U.S.-Latin American relations. This is the first of 21 events that will extend through next Monday. For a listing of all the events, we encourage you to pick up a brochure in the back of the room. The title of today's forum is The Post-Hemispheric Americans, Beyond Bridges and Borders in the 21st Century. Our guest is Dr. Evan Ward, an associate professor of history at Brigham Young University. He is the author of Border Oasis, The Political Ecology of Water in the Colorado River Delta, 1940 to 1975, and Packaged Vacations, Tourism Development in the Spanish Caribbean. He teaches courses on history of Mexico, modern Latin America, and inter-American relations. Dr. Ward received his PhD from the University of Georgia in 2000. Please welcome Dr. Evan Ward.
Good morning. I'd like to thank Professor Jowers, the Hinckley Institute, and the sponsors of the Siciliano Forum for the opportunity to speak to you today. As a historian, it's a privilege to be invited to speak at a conference dealing so much with futurity. At the time I was asked to speak, I had intended to address the relationship between the United States and Mexico. However, as recent anticipation of changes in U.S.-Cuban relations has developed, I believe I have a unique perspective that bears on the relationship that I would like to share with you today. I've written extensively about the development of Cuban tourism and would like to share my impressions based in part on my research of some of the challenges U.S. institutions and individuals must consider as Cuba and the United States proceed in the 21st century. Quite frankly, I've been surprised at the coverage of what changes might take place when diplomatic and cultural doors between the two countries are once again thrown wide open. In the immediate wake of the announcement that the two countries might hasten their efforts towards normalization of relations, earlier this year, the major networks outfitted news teams for the relatively short trip to Havana from frigid New York, no doubt a welcome respite from the unusually snowy winter for the Scott Pelley's and Brian Williams of the world. Senior correspondents interviewed intellectuals and economic analysts about the expected tidal wave of tourists and American commercial interests that would wash over the Malecón, or the seawall fronting Havana Harbor, once relations normalized. Hotel chain executives opined about their projected entries to the Cuban market, and pundits offered their assessments as to the impact of U.S. political, social, and cultural influences on the island as the 21st century unfolded. These two-minute analyses, scripted against the backdrop of the decaying charm of old Havana, ancient wooden doors, stray dogs, and retooled Ford cars, or further afield in Varadero, the resort town frequented by Europeans, Canadians, and Asians, presented the prospective connections of the two countries as if Cuba's relationships beyond the Western Hemisphere, forged during five decades of relative isolation from the United States, would figure little into prospective policy. In contrast, I would like to suggest today that the future of the Americas has as much to do with thinking beyond bipolar relations with their iconic bridges and borders, two familiar symbols of U.S.-Latin American relations, and instead consider the reality of a multipolar world, one in which the United States will not only have to account for its relationship with each nation in the Americas, but also move towards a post-hemispheric America, where interactions between the states and the Americas, as well as with Europe, Asia, and Africa, figure more prominently into policy decisions. This approach is largely becoming accepted wisdom for students of U.S.-Latin American relations. Immigrants do not irresistibly flow north. Migration patterns are multipolar. Consider, for example, the steady stream of Haitians who, in the wake of the 2010 earthquake, chose to make the longer odyssey south to Brazil through Ecuador, Peru, and the back door of the Western Amazon to work on construction projects for the 2014 World Cup and the Olympic Games that will be held in Rio in 2016. Likewise, NAFTA, now at a post-adolescent 21, is no longer the only free trade agreement in the family. Mexico has turned southward towards Colombia, west towards East Asia, and east towards Western Europe to diversify its financial and trade opportunities. As a result, the American Express building, located near the Ángel de la Independencia in Mexico City, now sits in the shadow of the gleaming British bank-based HSBC Bank Tower. Likewise, Spanish investment in Mexican tourism eclipsed that from the United States in 2006, or as many as 9 years ago. The furtive trails of global drug trafficking also lead in all directions on the compass, Asia, Europe, and the Middle East. The multipolar present and future have eclipsed the binational models that was conventional wisdom in the 19th and 20th centuries. In order to emphasize the importance of envisioning a post-hemispheric America as we consider the future of the region, I would like to offer two vignettes that make this point, focusing on Cuba in particular. We will visit the Karl Marx Theater in the comfortably chic, tree-lined Havana suburb of Miramar, Cuba, and the white sand beaches of Varadero, located some 70 miles to the east of the Cuban capital, in hopes that we might recognize together today that the corporate and diplomatic decision makers, as well as media outlets that cover U.S.-Cuban relations in the future, are dealing with a very complicated tangle of global relations, more so than has been supposed. But first, we need to get to Havana legally. So please come with me on the short 30-minute flight from Miami to Havana on a charter jet authorized by the U.S. Department of Treasury. 11 years ago, as a faculty member at the university where I previously worked in Alabama, I was asked to travel to and participate in a UNESCO conference on higher education in February of 2004. On a sunny Friday evening in February of 2004, I found myself sitting on the 10th row of the Karl Marx Theater in Havana, Cuba, waiting for the closing ceremonies of the conference. The speaker for the event had not been announced, but anticipation was building. A steady stream of educators, primarily from Latin America, but also from the United Kingdom and other points European, filled in the rows around us, an island of three Americans. A throng of Cuban students bust in from the countryside to make sure that the event was a sellout, quickly filled the balconies. Given the tightened security and from the verbal buzz that circulated throughout the conference center during the previous 2 days, there was some reason to believe that President Castro would deliver the closing keynote address in advance of a dinner at the former Havana Country Club. Several minutes before the event began, a familiar face that I only recognized from grainy documentaries or in biographies crossed stage right, walked past the podium, and took his seat at the dais on the stage. He had traded fatigues for a smart suit. His once thick jet black beard was now a wizened mass of hazy gray and white hair. Yet, as if the Beatles had dropped out of the sky and onto the stage, Fidel had arrived. The meeting began at 6 p.m., and President Castro approached the podium at 7:45, carrying a hefty briefcase in his right hand, which he set down at the side of the podium and pulled out a really thick binder. His topic for the evening, fitting for the close of a conference on higher education, was the history of educational innovation in Cuba since 1959. By that time, in his late 70s, his charismatic flashes of invective and emotion, so characteristic of images of the early revolution, were now only intermittent. His extemporizing returned in fits and spurts, but he mainly read documents from his binder and then offered commentaries on changes in education during the course of the late 20th century. Castro talked at length about how in the 1960s, a lack of teachers for subjects including foreign languages brought about the need for innovation, in that case using television programs to teach language across the country. He conceded that this program had not been as rigorous or as successful as he might have hoped, but the man who carried the affairs of an island, of an entire country, in his head felt that the adaptation of technology to the needs of the population had been worth the effort. Castro continued to speak for the next 4 hours, growing impatient with the audience about 10:30 p.m. when they appeared to be losing interest. They urged him on, however, in a chorus of assent. He actually asked, "Are you ready for me to stop?" And he finished at 7:45. What I now remember most from that experience is that even if Cubans are anxious and perhaps better prepared than they have been given credit for to adapt free market economies, some aspects of the revolution will not be easily changed or vanquished come whatever changes may come. In that sense, we can expect perhaps a mixed political and economic society of the South, not mimicking the United States, but instead, in my best estimation, looking something like a European nation with free market economic conditions and pronounced social programs geared towards universal health and education. In retrospect, Cuba did not look to Western Europe as a model for its institutional ethos, yet it shared similar affinities and values with post-Cold War developments throughout the continent. Even more so than the other Eastern Bloc countries with which it was allied until the early 1990s. Paradoxically, I found Soviet influence in Cuban culture and society is almost non-existent on its landscapes. But Cuba shares much in common with the social values championed by members of the European Union. When the conference closed, I spent the next week conducting interviews in Havana and in the resort town of Varadero, some 70 miles to the east, as part of the research for my second book, Packaged Vacations, Tourism Development in the Spanish Caribbean. Doing historical research in Cuba presents interesting logistical and methodological challenges. As the historian Rosalie Schwartz noted in the introduction to her study of Cuban tourism prior to the Cuban Revolution, Pleasure Island, Tourism and Temptation in Cuba, forays into official archives are at present practically useless. So I completed as much archival work as possible on tourism development in Cuba as I could at repositories like the Hilton Hotel Archives at the University of Houston. In Cuba, I planned to conduct interviews with the administrators of European hotel chains, as well as with professors at institutions like the University of Havana, who specialized in the study of tourism development there since the late 1980s. Varadero is an extended peninsula that juts into the Caribbean. In 1928, Irene DuPont, of chemical manufacturing fame, sent one of his family's associates to Cuba to find property for a summer home. After inspecting Varadero, the DuPonts purchased most of the peninsula, including a crag that offers a majestic view of the Caribbean. It was there that the DuPonts built Xanadu, a luxurious family resort complete with golf course and panoramic views of the sea. The home remained in the family's possession until the Cuban Revolution, when it was taken over by the Cuban government. Today, you can buy postcards of revolutionaries Fidel and Che golfing on the DuPonts' private golf course at the Pro Shop. But during the revolution, it functioned as a school for literacy and then an artist's workshop. Today, it's a luxury boutique hotel. Varadero remained largely undeveloped beyond Xanadu or the DuPont mansion until the late 1980s. At that point, with Soviet assistance hanging in the balance, the Cuban government turned east towards Western Europe in an effort to stave off complete economic isolation and embarked on an extensive program to import Spanish, French, and Dutch expertise in developing businesses, including tourism. The Spanish hotel chain, Sol Meliá, built three hotels on the beaches near the DuPont mansion in the late 1980s and early 1990s. To stand between them, looking north towards the Caribbean from the peninsula, offers an apt metaphor for the rather complex economic and political relations that have escaped many of the futurologists who see a quick entrance of U.S. companies into Cuba once the diplomatic doors have been opened. European hotel administrators began to train Cubans in vocational schools and universities sponsored by the government in the late 1980s. While it is well known that this transfer of knowledge has taken place, less has been written about the ways in which a new generation of Cuban executives have adapted American business techniques to their tourism development strategies that have unfolded within a European business context. Some might think that this nod to the North suggests that Cuban executives and their European commercial partners will simply disappear or cede ground to U.S. businesses as soon as the embargo has been lifted. To me, this is counterintuitive. The Europeans and Cubans will be prepared for the tidal wave of American consumer and commercial interests and will force these newcomers to adapt and figuratively fight for a presence there. Just 2 days ago, Clement Doliak, a research fellow at the Council on Hemispheric Affairs, and Louis G. Guest wrote in an essay on the ways in which U.S.-Cuban rapprochement will affect relations between the European Union and Cuba, quote, "It seems quite unlikely that the Cubans will show more interest towards U.S. companies than what is needed to keep them in the game and maintain their pressure on U.S. politicians. If we believe the Cuban response to their partners' concern of being left on the side of the road, Cubans will not forget those who were on their side during the last decades. Undoubtedly, these problems are going to take a long time to be solved, and the U.S.-Cuban economic relationship will need decades to reach its full potential. During that time, the European Union firms and government cooperation are still free to invest in the field and to create privileged links with Cuba. Thus, this crowded market which U.S. companies encounter will mirror to a certain degree the entry of the United States to the China market in the early 20th century, which, not without a certain irony, involved defeat of the Spanish Empire in Cuba and the Philippines as a precursor to ambitious plans for Asian trade. Historians agree that the proclamation of an open-door policy to Asia, at that time had little effect, as European powers had already established a significant presence in the Chinese market at that time. In contrast, in the 21st century, private and public decision makers would do well to develop a healthy respect for European, Canadian, and Latin American entities that now have a long history of working in Cuba and are familiar with the society, that will not irresistibly conform to the cultural and political norms of newcomers from the North. In short, we have much to learn from those that have been in Cuba for so long, including the ways in which Cubans have adapted business strategies from the United States within the framework of non-U.S. institutional structures. And I just want to share a couple of examples with this before concluding. At the Iberostar Barlovento Hotel in Varadero, for example, a member of the management team noted that the Spanish hotel chain sent its Cuban employees to Cancun and the Riviera Maya to, quote, see hotels in another country and how they operated, close quote. Such a procedure, much like the educational tours that Cuban students used to take to the United States to see factories at the turn of the 20th century, and I refer you to one of the deans of the history of U.S.-Cuban relations, Louis Perez, Jr., in his book, Cuba and the United States, Singular Ties of Intimacy. He talks about these trips that Cuban students would take to the U.S. To view the Second Industrial Revolution taking place. These forays by Cuban executives in the 20th century, 21st century, was, as Ms. Diaz observed, part of the regular training module, close quote. Throughout my research in Cuba, I found that this method of adapting U.S. business practices to European corporate structures was common, not just at the corporate level, but also in government-run tourism schools. In a meeting with the director of quality control for the government-owned hotel management firm, Cubanacan, for example, I was informed that the chain received feedback and instruction from Ritz-Carlton, who had been invited to Cuba 5 years earlier. Company executives visited hotels in Cancun and Acapulco to benchmark personnel training techniques. The director also noted that she had visited schools in Holland and the Canary Islands for several months for extended training. Subsequently, implementing methods from hotel chains such as Hyatt Regency and Camino Real in Mexico provided the leverage for Cuban businesses such as Cubanacan to open its own hotels in Cancun and other parts of Mexico. I'll also note that since publishing the book, Packaged Vacations, that you know some of these contracts and arrangements based on Cuban expertise in the hospitality industry have been transferred to places like mainland China. So the agreements, the expertise has been developed on the island and then in some senses is now being exported to other parts of the world. Later that day, I spoke with the director of human resources for Cubanacan, who informed me that he, too, had traveled to Cancun as well as to Jamaica to supplement the training he received in Cuba. Vocational schools were also in the process of designing courses on human resource development with global expertise. Efforts were underway, he noted, with universities in Mexico to provide such training. Conversely, European firms have learned a great deal from conducting business in Cuba, including how to adapt their procedures and practices to a mixed economy with unique social programs. In conclusion, there is some truth to George Santayana's famous maxim that those who do not learn from history are doomed to repeat it, but the future always unfolds in a different context than the past. And that's what makes the link between past, present, and future so intriguing. I had one of those moments when centuries crossed paths on one of my last days in Cuba, when I visited the governor's palace, where Spanish and then U.S. authorities governed the island. Today it has been transformed into a museum of colonial Havana and the Spanish legacy there. In one of the exhibits, there are a few relics from the USS Maine, accompanied by a quote that takes its original context from the advent of U.S. influence in Cuba at the end of the 19th century. At the time, Spanish colonial administrator Ramon Blanco wrote, quote, "We Spaniards and Cubans now find ourselves face to face with a stranger of a distinctive race and of an acquisitive nature, whose intentions are to keep Spain from raising its flag on Cuban soil. Therefore, the supreme moment has arrived in that we forget our past differences and that united, Cubans and Spaniards, we reject the invaders for our own defense." When this was uttered some 120 years ago, it was not intended to have relevance in the 21st century, but in light of the strong ties that have reemerged between Europe and Cuba, as well as with Canada and Latin America, its spirit might be fruitful for policymakers to consider anew. Europe still matters in relation to the future of the Americas. An increased Asian commercial and social presence throughout the hemisphere, another topic for another day, also looms large on the horizon. On the positive side, according to Dr. Frank Mora, former Deputy Assistant for Hemispheric Defense during the first Obama administration, who spoke at BYU in 2013 at the Wheatley Institution, people-to-people diplomacy throughout the hemisphere has never been stronger, and the U.S. maintains important and innovative ties through traditional diplomatic and military channels. In my own experience, Cubans are as eager to renew ties with their neighbors to the north as my students are to interact with their counterparts across the straits of the Florida Keys. Nevertheless, the idea that the Americas function chiefly as a byproduct of binational relations, with a shield raised against extra-hemispheric influences, is largely a relic of the past. As in Cuba, U.S. public and corporate citizenship throughout the hemisphere will function best as it considers the multipolar web of relationships between Latin American countries, as well as the fact that, much like the United States, evolving global priorities have hemispheric repercussions, including in the fields of immigration, drug trafficking, national security, and cultural hybridity. Thank you for your time.
Okay, we'll open it up to questions now. Please state your name or major, something about yourself before you ask a question.
Hi, my name is Molly Wheeler. I work next door. We spoke earlier. I was wondering what the state of education and higher education looked like now in Cuba and kind of how that was impacting their economy and kind of what sectors of labor they were working with right now and how that's projected to change.
Sure. I think one sector that is in the forefront of economic strategy, past and I think future as well, is in the field of healthcare and medicine. And I think that the future is strong for Cuba, particularly in its educational system, in primary care, health, pedagogy. It's very interesting that I would think that most of the international students that are studying in Cuba now are studying at the International Medical School there. And their focus is to become primary care physicians. The resources are quite limited, but in terms of the entrepreneurial side of healthcare, we've already seen and will continue to see a new branch of the hospitality industry, which is specialized medical procedures. So there's kind of a juxtaposition. In terms of education, the focus in medical schools is on primary care, but in terms of raising foreign currencies has been a move towards specialization of different techniques. And I think that market, as in Europe, will probably be there as long as there are fields that in the United States are still yet to be tested and tried. I'll make a comment. When I was in Cuba in 2004, I was able to meet some of the students from the International Medical School, and they actually play a very prominent life, I think, in the religious life of religious institutions from the United States that have developed a presence in Cuba in the last decade. And so in that sense, you have students from Latin America, even some from the United States, bringing their cultural experience and values with them, and then taking back this commitment to health care, to primary care practices. And I think that's something that will probably continue in the future.
My name is Montana. I'm a political science major and philosophy minor. It's kind of two questions. As we talk about Cuba, we hear a lot about the statistics and how things have changed and what good, you know, society and economy that they're, you know, developing. One is how do we feel that we can trust the numbers that are being reported, since typically, historically, communist one-party regimes have not been very accurate in reporting their statistics and their figures. And the second part of my question is, upon opening relations with Cuba, how can we expect something different than, let's say, our relationship with Venezuela, that's a very similar type government and that's experiencing a lot of economic turmoil, and our embassy's been kicked out of the country several times? How can we expect something different upon beginning trade and, you know, relations with Cuba?
Well, and I think that these are trends within Latin America that will have to be taken into account. Let me address your first question about trusting the numbers. As a historian, the documents and records that I'm most familiar with would have been in Cuban archives, and I didn't. That's not. Historians are very wary of what's there and what is presented, and so you have to kind of come up with your own methods of how you're going to do research there. And I think that could probably be extended as well to the data that's being presented as well. You bring up a very good point about trends in Latin American politics in the last 10 years, which is a move to the left, at least maybe coming back a little to center-left. But these tendencies within the hemisphere, I think, are going to be create something of an intransigence, just as the relationships that Cuba's formed outside of the hemisphere will also limit the degree of change. And so I'm optimistic about the possibility of exchange opening up, but I think that it's going to take a lot longer, and to a large extent will follow trends throughout the rest of Latin America in political choices and tendencies.
Sorry to be a question hog. So what is your perspective on opening things back up with Cuba? Is it long overdue? Is it something that should have been done years ago? Or is it something we should proceed with caution? Kind of what's your take on this new policy shift?
I don't know that I necessarily have. I guess my best opinion would be that it's something that is like a dinosaur that's been around a long time, and I do think that it may have hindered the ability of the United States to engage in Latin American politics in this shift to the left, shift to the center. And any type of engagement there, I think, will also provide benefits elsewhere throughout Latin America. I think that it will impact relations with the United States. President Peña Nieto from Mexico and President Obama met last month, and one of the things that they talked about was the relationship with Cuba. I think that that will open up channels elsewhere, and it'll be one of the most important indirect effects of the engagement. But just as a personal opinion, I'd say that it's probably long overdue.
Anybody, one last question?
I'm sorry this was so, it went more quickly than I thought. I thought that it would. Are we still recording? Okay. Well, I think that's a good point to end on.
All right. Well, thank you all for being here, and join me in thanking Evan Ward for this very insightful and informative forum.